Okay, we'll convene the Civil Justice Committee, there being a quorum. First bill on the agenda will be House File 988. Representative Mariani. Representative Johnson, do you want to move the bill? Me too. Representative Johnson moves House File 988 to the General Register. Representative Mariani, do you want to go ahead and present your bill? Is there any amendments?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. No, we have no amendments.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I will be very brief. I'm chairing a committee right now, believe it or not, somewhere else as well, and I know members are very busy. I have a big agenda today. House File 988 is pretty simple, basically. It prohibits the Commissioner of Public Safety from implementing steps that would have the state of Minnesota comply with the federal real ID mandate. We've been through a couple of committees. We've been successful in having bipartisan support moving this through. This bill was presented last year, was heard on the bill on the floor twice, with enormous support both in the House and the Senate from both sides of the aisle. We passed very similar provisions, basically saying no to the federal mandate of real ID, which creates a national ID card and basically has the federal government take over our driver's license. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stop and turn to my witness and have her provide you with a little bit more information.
Okay. Please state your name.
Good morning. I'm Carolyn Jackson with the ACLU of Minnesota.
Go ahead.
The Federal ID Act passed, the federal government passed the Real ID Act in 2005 without debate or hearing, as part of the Indonesian Tsunami Relief Bill. On January 11, 2008, the Department of Homeland Security issued its final regulations for implementing the Real ID Act. On May 17, 2008, Governor Plenty signed an executive order prohibiting implementation of the Real ID Act in Minnesota until June 1, 2009. There was no funding for Real ID in the federal stimulus package, and there is no current plan in Congress to further fund Real ID. The last money available to Minnesota was a grant for $694,000, which the state has already received. According to Department of Vehicle Services testimony, receipt of this grant does not legally obligate Minnesota to comply with Real ID. In April of 2008, the Department of Vehicle Services estimated the cost of Real ID at approximately $12 million in startup costs and $19 million ongoing annual costs. Real ID raises serious privacy issues. It mandates a system of linked databases for all states to share driver's license information. Because we do not know what the infrastructure of this system will look like, there is no way to know how the privacy of Minnesotans' personal information will be safeguarded. Furthermore, the Real ID Act violates the Constitution in a number of ways. It burdens Americans' right to travel, which has been recognized as a right by the U.S. Supreme Court under the First Amendment. In addition, because a Real ID will be required to enter federal buildings, including a courthouse, there are significant implications for Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment due process, the Sixth Amendment right to a trial before a jury of one's peers, and the First Amendment right to petition government officials. Real ID also requires, without any exemption, that visual photographs appear on each identification card. This requirement violates the First Amendment's protected religious beliefs of several religious groups, including the Amish, Mennonites, Muslim women, and conservative Christian sects. While the Real ID regulations acknowledge religious objections, they do not offer a real solution to this constitutional problem. Instead, they assert that states can provide religious objectors with non-Real ID compliant licenses, which will restrict their right to travel, their ability to access federal offices, and violate Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment equal protection rights. The determination of whether a state's driver's license complies with Real ID lies within the discretion of the Secretary of Homeland Security. Unless Congress repeals or drastically changes Real ID, in December of this year, Secretary Napolitano will determine whether any state's driver's license is in, quote, material compliance with Real ID. As Governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano signed an anti-Real ID statute even more strictly worded than House File 998. Nonetheless, it is highly likely that she will find the Arizona driver's license to be in material compliance. This shows the extreme and arbitrary power created for the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under Real ID, and another reason it should be repealed. The Real ID Act cannot really be fixed. This is why 11 states, Georgia, Maine, Montana, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Washington, Alaska, Arizona, Idaho, and Louisiana, and that's approximately 48 million people, have enacted statutes opting out of the program. 9 additional states, Arkansas, Colorado, Hawaii, Illinois, Nebraska, Nevada, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Tennessee, have passed resolutions to opt out or demand that Congress repeal Real ID. Anti-Real ID legislation is currently on the desk of the Virginia governor. It is time for the Minnesota to act and demand to be released from the deeply flawed federal mandate.
Representative Mariani, I think, is there anybody in the in opposition to this bill? Okay, I don't think we need to just have any more testimony. Is there any discussion of the bill? We've heard it many times. Okay, all in favor of Representative Johnson's motion to pass 988 and send it to the General Register, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay. Representative Hodge. Somebody want to Representative Mahoney move House File 120, and it has to go to Finance, I believe. That's correct.
Mr. Chair, correct.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 120 deals with Department of Health oversight over the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative. The Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative is a cooperative that serves 23 critical access hospitals. Just so you know what a critical access hospital means, is a federal designation of an area that's significantly underserved by the market. They serve 24 primary care physicians and clinics and 10 specialty clinics. Actually, the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative is a result of 1994 legislation that gave authorization for healthcare cooperatives. And the goals of that legislation were explicitly written in the legislation that the goals are containing healthcare costs, improving the quality of healthcare, and increasing the access of Minnesota citizens to healthcare services. I don't think it's a surprise to members of this committee or anybody in the legislature that rural areas have had struggles with physician recruitment, providing coverage to their area, and Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative gives the measures and the mechanisms in order to represent different clinics and hospitals within the healthcare market. I appreciate your consideration. I hope to get the committee support, and I will allow Mr. Neff, who is the executive director, to address the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Westrom?
I don't believe the bill has been moved. If you want, I'll move House File.
Representative Westrom, it has been moved.
It has.
What, did you say Neffson?
Neff. My name is Chuck Neff.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Neff.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Chuck Neff. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative. Thank you very much for this opportunity today. We're a small organization with four FTE staff. Our office is rent space from a hot tub store in the town of Cottonwood, Minnesota. As Representative Hodge said, we have 23 critical access hospitals and then roughly 34 clinics in western Minnesota. The range of our membership is from Glencoe west to South Dakota border, north at Elbow Lake, south to Slayton. So it's kind of that part of the state. One of the probably the big thing we offer for both our members and the health plans, frankly, is the one-stop shopping for a number of services, fairly labor-intensive and travel-intensive too. Single signature contracting on behalf of our membership in all that geographic area. Credentialing, we do delegated credentialing for people, even offering better credentialing services than the health plans do, where we do professional references where most health plans do not for physicians. We also do joint quality projects both for various ones that the health plans request, but also any kind of like Minnesota community measurement, those kind of things. We're also looking at becoming an ICSI member now in April because they just changed their bylaws allowing groups like us to join, and we're going to be integrating that in our shared health information technology project coming later. We also have shared or a joint complaint reporting process that we provide for the health plans, where we prompt our members to get their information to us, and then we compile it and send it to the health plans on a regular basis. Another additional value-added thing that we provide our members is we do a number of patient satisfaction surveys, including HCAHPS surveys, which helps critical access hospitals prepare and fix any kind of outstanding issues they might have before the CMS starts reporting things publicly. Basically, our mission is to try and keep members viable and their doors open. One of the mutual benefits, again, for both our members and the health plans is to keep our members independent. What happens if people can't make it in rural Minnesota, probably anywhere in Minnesota, is they end up selling to the larger networks like Mayo or Allina and, you know, Avera, Sanford, those kind of places. So it's in everybody's best interest to keep things local. Last thing I'd mention is we're currently working on a very, very ambitious project. We have a $500,000 state department or Office of Rural Health primary care grant on our shared HIT project for the eHealth initiative, $500,000 grant, and we're also securing other grants. Our mission is just to try and help keep clinics and hospitals viable in western Minnesota, and that's really all we're about. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there any testimony from anyone else that wants to speak on the bill? Okay, do you want to speak on the bill?
In opposition.
Okay, would you come up right away? Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Purcell. I'm a partner at the Lindquist and Venom Law Firm. I'm here because I'm antitrust counsel for the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And I have been practicing healthcare antitrust law for over 23 years here in Minnesota, including dealing with a number of organizations such as the Minnesota Rural Healthcare Cooperative, in my previous role as the person in charge of the state antitrust division. I was in charge of the state antitrust enforcement for about 13 years under Attorney General Humphrey, and I've been continuing to practice in this area since coming into private practice. I'm here to oppose this bill because the health plans, not only the theory of antitrust, but the health plan's actual experience of this arrangement and similar arrangements is that they raise the cost of health care. They significantly raise the cost of health care. Now, you've heard a number of things from Mr. Ness about the kinds of projects that the Minnesota Rural Healthcare Cooperative has been doing. All of those projects are praiseworthy things that don't need any protection from the health department or any oversight. They raise no specific antitrust problems. They don't need any kind of an exemption. The thrust of this bill and the purpose of this bill is to ask you to sanction conduct that amounts to price fixing. Let me give you an example of what kind of activities I'm talking about. A representative from one of the health plans was negotiating with the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative not long ago, and she was confronted with the situation where virtually all of the providers went into a room, decided on what prices that they were going to charge, came out and made their demands, and implicitly threatened to boycott the health plan if they didn't get their pricing. That is a classic price-fixing boycott, and I believe that you all have in your package or have received before a letter from the Federal Trade Commission, which essentially makes the same point. The Federal Trade Commission, which doesn't speak lightly about these matters, opposes this legislation specifically, and not based, I'll tell you, on some theoretical construct, but based on the fact that they have been engaged in an investigation of the Minnesota Rural Healthcare Cooperative for several years. So they know this market, and their opposition to this legislation and to this kind of activity is knowledgeable, it's well-founded, and it is also quite firm. Just to give you a couple of examples of how the effect of this organization over the years, the clinics in this consortium, in this cartel, I think we can call it, are currently making 140% of the same charges that are charged by their peers in other regions of the state. This is a testament to the fact that they actually do raise prices with their joint negotiation. And that's really what this is all about. They are asking you to sanction, under a health department process, a joint negotiation strategy which, if there is no exemption, would amount to price fixing and would leave them liable for antitrust violations. Now, I have the benefit of having been around this issue for a long time, including back in the early 1990s, during the first round of healthcare reform, when the state very carefully considered the issue of antitrust exemptions, and in fact passed a bill which has some faint echoes in the proposal that is before you right now, but which really would do what the state needs to have done, and that is oversee these arrangements for the benefits of consumers, and also regulate the entities so that they truly do have antitrust immunity. Because without that, the true process that would look at and carefully examine and do an economic analysis of the effect of the activities of this rural healthcare cooperative, there is no consumer protection. And in fact, it's not just health plans who will be paying more, it will be individual people too. For example, emergency room visits for this outfit average approximately $800, whereas in other parts of the state it's in the mid-300s. Part of that cost is inevitably going to come out of the pockets of individual people, the constituents and patients in western Minnesota. And that's something that we don't think that is contemplated in healthcare reform or in cost containment. And just to conclude, Mr. Chairman, I realize that sometimes people are prone to say, well, the health plans are here opposing this. The health plans are big insurance companies, and these are just the little guys out in southwestern Minnesota. That's not the dynamic that is presented when a health plan negotiator goes out and is confronted with a group that represents virtually all of these clinics and hospitals in an area. And these are the folks, the health plans, who are out there trying to get better prices for people. They get lower premiums for people who want to buy health insurance. This is an obstacle. I hope that you will listen to the fact that they're telling you their experience is that this will be bad for health care costs, and we ask you to reject this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure. Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to address a few things, and also with us today is we have David Balto, who was a lawyer with the FTC for 20 years, who can also address some of these claims. A few things I'd like to address, however. I think the claim of price fixing is a stretch, to say the least. Included in your material should be cost comparison for the 23 hospitals at the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative. Represent, and you can see the different cost comparisons in almost all the areas. Their averages are below the region, below the state of Minnesota, and below hospitals of a similar size. And I think that's important. We can talk about that, you know, claims that 140% reimbursements are being provided, but those are merely claims. I would like to see some actual proof of that. Secondly, if that is the case, then I don't think we'd be seeing a physician shortage in rural Minnesota, and I don't think we'd be seeing an access problem in rural Minnesota, and that if there was 140% reimbursement, that's where everybody would be flocking to. So I'm sorry, I have somewhat of a problem with that. It's also clear that health plans have the right to negotiate with these individual hospitals and individual clinics if they want to. This does not prohibit them from negotiating on an individual basis. So that is another clarification I would like to address. I encourage the members of the committee to thoroughly read House File 120. It does not change the practices that are currently occurring with the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative, which they've been doing for 14 years. If this has been such a problem, I would have expected that this would have been a larger issue 3, 4, 5, 10 years ago. But it's not. This simply provides Department of Health oversight to make sure that there aren't nefarious actions going on, and it gives review that is completely paid for and not an impact to the state of Minnesota. So I would appreciate the committee's continued consideration and support.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to those 2 points?
Mr. Purcell?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. The sheet that you handed out, or that you see that has the hospital and the prices on it, is nominal prices. It's their bill charges. Hospital contracting is all about getting discounts for the benefit of consumers. And the question is, what do people really get? What are people really willing to pay? What kind of discounts are the providers willing to give? Not what they put on a price sheet.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just reading this letter from the Federal Trade Commission. It's really nice to see the rural health community is being accused of coercion, imitation, boycott, or concerted refusal to deal. Feels like a good union deal. I'm going to vote for this.
Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, to the witness, Mr. Purcell, so is it illegal to boycott the health plan, but the health plans can boycott the hospitals without repercussion? Is that how the law is written?
Mr. Chairman, that's actually correct. It is unlawful for competitors to get together to do certain kinds of things. It's unlawful for competitors to get together to set prices, and it's unlawful for competitors to get together and decide jointly that they won't do business with somebody else. A health plan is a single entity, and the health plan's decision not to contract with somebody because they charge too much is no different legally than your decision not to buy a new car because it costs too much.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Purcell, what you're telling me in your statement prior to my question about the charges is these other hospitals can charge the private pay a higher amount so they can give it away to the health care plans, and then they can turn around and not contract with the small clinics because they say they don't charge, they charge too much. Is that basically what you're telling us?
Mr. Purcell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative, I think your statement is raising issues about subsidization and pricing among different groups that aren't really necessarily material to this bill. A health plan, like any other business, and like any one of the people in this rural healthcare cooperative, can individually decide not who they want to do business with, yay or nay. It's the getting together to assemble the market share of this group and making a joint decision, which effectively can block people from the market, which is unlawful.
Mr. Chair,
Representative West.
I might take a little issue with it. Let me walk you through another example. We have co-ops all over in rural Minnesota. Senex, you happen to maybe know that name. They band together to buy and decide who they're going to do business with. So, Mr. Purcell, are you telling us that that's an illegal activity as well, and the Federal Trade Commission is got them under investigation?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Purcell.
Representative, the answer would be yes, but for a federal law exemption that specifically authorizes agricultural cooperatives to do that kind of joint purchasing. That there is no federal law, which in this case authorizes healthcare providers to do this kind of joint negotiation. In fact, quite the contrary, that's why the Federal Trade Commission is here. That's why we believe that this is price fixing.
Well, last comment, Mr. Chair. Mr. Purcell, when I first was elected to office, some of my rural providers were wringing their hands because the health care providers wouldn't give them a contract as a part of a network because they were too small of a facility. So they were going to the bigger facilities in the area and in the state. And one of the requirements was, well, you've got to send all your consumers here if we in Hospital X are going to contract with you, and basically lock the small companies or small providers out of the marketplace. At that time, they demonstrated to me procedure after procedure after procedure after procedure that was substantially cheaper in the Elbow Lake, in the other Appleton, in the other small hospitals of the state, that they were paying more for in bigger facilities. Yet they somehow thought that was a savings, and if they thought it was a smart move to be able to lock out the small providers, so those of us in small communities now would get to drive 45 minutes or an hour to a provider instead of five blocks from my house. For instance, and so I'm trying to sort through where the fact and fiction is here, but it seems strange to me that the providers can collude and block out the little providers and say you're too small, but then on the flip side, when they want to become a bigger network, say now you're illegal. And so maybe to your earlier testimony, maybe that's the reason for this bill. If Senex can do it for the farmers, maybe this bill can do it for the rural health care consumers as well.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Purcell, very short.
I would simply like to direct your attention to the fact that the old antitrust exemption process in the statute that was repealed in 1997, enacted in 93, repealed in 97, in which the health plans are now offering as an amendment to this bill to enable the very kind of activity that you're concerned about. That bill has provides a process that would truly scrutinize and balance access versus cost versus quality, and have the health department making a thorough decision that is sure to protect consumers and balance the state's health care policy objectives. The bill that's before you right now does not ensure that kind of a process. It is far too scant to ensure that kind of an intelligent weighing of the factors that you just mentioned.
Representative Johnson.
I'll pass the...
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but if this bill should pass, the antitrust exemption would apply to any health care cooperative set up across the state.
Mr. Chair, one of the problems with this bill is that, in fact, it's not simply confined to the Minnesota Rural Health Care Cooperative. This kind of joint negotiating activity could be encouraged in other parts of the state and have almost a geometric effect on the increase of health care costs. That's correct.
Okay, Representative Fulver. Representative Haas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, this is already existing law of 1994. I do not believe this extends the antitrust immunity to anybody beyond what is currently in law. If you look at one point, this is simply Department of Health oversight in making sure that certain conditions are considered to make sure that the operations are legitimate and for the consumer, for health care, and for insurers. And if you look at the three standards from 2.32 to 3.2, I think you can see that. This does not change how things are currently done already, and that's why I'm so amazed that this is such a problem, because if this was such a problem, I would have assumed action or initiatives prior to today to try to repeal what we passed in 1994.
Thank you. And so my next question, Mr. Chair, then would be to the testifier. Do you agree with that statement?
Mr. Purcell.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. There has been a real sea change in the kind of activities that the health plans and other buyers have seen from the from cooperative members, especially this cooperative. The kinds of activities that Mr. Ness talked about, joint credentialing, joint quality projects, and so forth, which have been the traditional core of these healthcare cooperatives under Chapter 62R, are perfectly fine. But in recent years, it is the sad fact that the providers in this group have become far more aggressive about their price negotiations, and they have banded together in a way which drives prices up in a way that I'm quite confident the Federal Trade Commission will find violates the antitrust law.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Haas, you said that there wasn't any problem, so why do we need this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, to provide the oversight that the FTC has indicated some concerns, that this would be a mechanism, you know, to have the Department of Health, which is an independent body, to do review of the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative, and we put the standards in the legislation, you know, for what they must consider. So that's why we need this. We're not changing current practices. We're not changing the law that authorized Minnesota Rural Health Cooperatives from 1994. We're simply providing what I think is greater consumer protection by having a form of oversight that currently now doesn't exist.
Thank you. Representative
Hover,
did you have another question?
It wasn't exactly that there was no problem. There is a problem because the FTC has expressed some problems. And when I'm looking at the letter from them that was written to Representative Emmer, they also expressed concerns with House File 120. And there's also, in their letter, they reference a request for the MRHC to notify relevant legislative committees that their prior representations of FTC staff were not accurate. Has that letter been put forward?
Representative
Hyde. It's referenced on page 3 of the Emmer letter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, I believe from one of our first hearings, there were some representations made that may have been taken out of context, and they were clarified by the testifier, who said that they weren't implying that the FTC would do, that this wouldn't create any actions from the FTC if this were to pass. I think there were some implications saying that if this were to pass, the FTC would drop all their concerns. That was clarified by the testifier that they weren't speaking to the FTC. So I mean that is clarified, and I think we've gone past that.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment. I know that we're busy today. I won't take a whole lot of time about it. I don't know if you want to deal with that at this point.
Representative Holberg, if you're going to have an amendment, let's get it on and discuss it real quickly. At this rate, we're going to be here till evening. Members have to remember that we are going to finish this calendar somehow today. We have to. So, Representative Holberg, go ahead if you want to.
I don't know if the pages have it or
you want to
pass out.
We have it. It's been out.
Okay.
Do you want to move the 283 amendment? Then?
I would.
Holberg moves the 283 amendment.
And basically what this is trying to do is go back to the standard that Mr. Purcell referenced. That was in place and would provide more oversight, and that we want to have approval by default as far as running out of time, as is presented in the Haas bill, would have a little more oversight, and from my understanding, would probably be more in line with what the FTC is looking for.
Thank you.
And I know that Mr. Purcell is familiar with the amendment. I don't know if he wants to further explain.
Representative Purcell, do you want to further explain very shortly? I'm sorry. What did I say? I called him representative. I'm sorry about the
Chairman, I promise you, never run
here.
Family. I don't want you to get me in trouble.
Mr.
Chairman, the previous bill, the state antitrust exemption that was in process before, it consists of 10 sections, and that would very methodically go through and make sure that the kind of evidence is there to protect consumers that the, that, that both state health care policy and the federal antitrust laws would require for immunity. There is, in particular, the criteria for decision are very meticulously laid out. A critical point is that the there's public input in it. It's not a, this is not a process that would be done simply on a review of an application or even a kind of a pocket veto or a pocket approval of an application that's provided in the current bill. People who are affected by it, including consumers, including health plans, including government buyers, and or employers who might have their health care costs driven up, would have the ability to get notice of the application and participate in the process. If appropriate, there would be a full contested case hearing and a process that would really result in the kind of findings that would protect consumers.
Thank you, Mr.
That's another.
Purcell, I apologize for demeaning you by calling you representative, but at least I didn't call you worse like a senator. So,
Mr. Chairman, it's bad enough to be a lawyer.
Representative Hosh, did you want to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Holberg on the amendment. At this point, I would oppose it, but I do want to say that I'm willing to talk to the health plans. They did bring this up as a concept yesterday, but if you look at the date stamp on this, this was done sometime after midnight because it's got today's date, and I haven't had a chance to look through it in its entirety. This is a third committee that we've been in front of, so at this point, I would oppose it. But with the indication that I'd be willing to consider some of their concerns, but I would encourage the committee to not support that amendment.
Thank you, Representative Posh.
Mr. Chair, I'm particularly concerned with your bill in that there's a default approval for a lack of action, and I think that there should be some type of public comment process in your bill as well, which are both lacking. So. I mean, this just puts more structure to it, and I appreciate that you're willing to at least look at it, and I'm assuming my amendment's going to get defeated, so.
Okay, all in favor of the 283 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Are you sure, Representative Wexler?
Sir, take my eye off of it. The secondhand smoke aroma I'm smelling over here. That's got me a little fuzzy.
All opposed to the 283 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. It fails. Representative Mahoney renews his motion to send House File 120 to finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Representative Hosh, you might as well just stay there.
What?
Representative Hosh, I said you might as well stay there. You're up again. House File 1709. Representative Johnson, your hand was up. Was that to move the bill? Okay, Representative Johnson moves House File 1709. Representative Hosh, go ahead and present the bill.
All right.
Go ahead, Representative Hosh.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 1709. Is the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Policy Bill. It makes generally technical changes throughout our law, addresses some changes to the Interstate Compact for the Placement of Children, which is a general compact among all 50 states, and also addresses some changes to comply with the Fostering Connections to Success and Increasing Adoptions Act of 2008 at the federal level. I have spoken enough already today, Mr. Chair, so I will hand it over to the department to describe the details of the bill.
Okay, please state your name.
I'm Christine Borsheim with the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative Hodge has just mentioned that the much of this bill is technical changes. That's the first article of the bill And again, as we stated, most of that is actually related to the interstate compact and the placement of children. Other technical amendments are simply changes to site references and so on. The majority of this bill is in Article 2, which is child welfare policy. And there's a lot of language, but most of it can be framed within four broad priority areas, and that is to expand roles and responsibilities for the tribes that we are working with under the American Indian Child Welfare Initiative, clarifying reasons for removal of children from their homes and enhancing reunification efforts, improving efforts to involve more fathers in child placement and custody matters, and achieving alignment with the provisions of the Federal Fostering Connections to Success and Increasing Adoptions Act. So much of the language that you're going to hear will actually reflect those priorities. Section 1 of the policy part is as a provision in the data privacy statute to allow child support to share data with child welfare for the purpose of establishing parentage and locating parents. This supports permanency and is consistent with changes in federal law. Section 2 allows tribes participating in the Indian Child Welfare Initiative to conduct children's mental health screenings and to establish local child mortality review panels. The tribes will provide written notice to the commissioner and affected counties when a local child mortality review panel is established. Section 3 contains an amendment to clarify that the requirement to search the Minnesota Father's Adoption Registry does not apply when the agency is proceeding under safe place for newborns. Section 4 makes a limitation on asserting an interest in a child where a putative father does not register with the Father's Adoption Registry applicable in both adoption and termination of parental rights proceedings. Section 5 helps us comply with federal requirements in part. It pertains to amending reasonable efforts, standards to prevent placement and finalize a permanent plan for a child. The amendment identifies safety plans as an effort to prevent placement and clarifies that reasonable efforts standards to prevent placement does not apply when community services cannot meet a child with a disability's need for treatment. When placement is necessary, this section clarifies that the child's relatives are to be contacted and provided notice consistent with 260C and identifies efforts to place siblings together or ensure sibling visitation. Section 6 aligns the definition of foster care in Chapter 260B, which is a delinquency statute, with the definition of foster care in Chapter 260C. Further, Sections 8, 9, and 21 ensure that foster care is intended to provide for child safety, the safety of others, or to access treatment. It clarifies that foster care must not be used as a punishment or consequence for the child's behavior. Section 7 amends the considerations of the juvenile treatment screening team to consider the availability of community services when determining if out-of-home placement is necessary for child with disabilities. Sections 10 and 11 clarify the definition of a parent and add provisions to the statute to ensure diligent efforts to identify, locate, and notify both parents of a child. These efforts include the use of genetic testing and other diligent efforts that agency must make to find parents. These efforts do not apply to the safe place for newborn situations. Sections 12, 13, 14, and 15 provide procedures to issue a notice or summons when filing a petition for termination of parental rights. It ensures that a summons is issued to a parent and a notice is issued to a grandparent with the right to participate, and it makes it clear that it's not a requirement to notify a putative father who has not registered with the Father's Adoption Registry. Sections 16 and 30 provide the juvenile court with the authority to use alternative dispute processes such as family group decision-making, parallel protection processes, or mediation to resolve child welfare matters when that's appropriate and in the best interest of the child. Sections 17 and 18 concern police officers taking the child into immediate custody under a 72-hour police hold. When a child runs away from a parent or guardian, the statute is amended to order that the police officer may transport the child home to a relative or to another safe place, and it eliminates running away as a reason for taking a child into custody. When a child is taken into custody for any reason, the statute is amended to provide social service agencies with the authority to release the child from custody after an assessment and implementation of a safety plan for the child. Section 19 is amended to remove running away as a reason to maintain a child in custody and adds reasonable effort standards to place siblings together and develop a plan for sibling visitation if placement together is not possible. Sections 20 and 22 ensure that the responsible social service agency has a duty to develop and implement a plan for parent visitation. It also sets uniform procedures to address visitation for a parent who has had limited or no contact with a child. Section 21 specifies that if a court finds a child is in need of protection or services because the child is a runaway or a habitual truant, the child may not be placed in foster parents' punishment. The remaining sections are primarily to achieve consistency with the federal act that we mentioned earlier. Section 23 amends the required content of our out-of-home placement plan. It requires the plan of specific efforts to ensure the child's health care needs are met.
And first I'm going to ask, is there anybody in opposition to this bill? Because we have a really long schedule, and I'm not sure everybody wants to know every detail. Does anybody on the committee want a lot more testimony? Okay. Ms. Borsham, I think we can go ahead. Does anybody on the committee want to discuss this before we vote? Okay. Representative Johnson renews his motion to pass House File 1709 to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry. Representative Simon. Somebody want to move? Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson moves House File 1677. And does this go to the floor, Representative Simon? For the General Register. Okay, Representative Simon, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill has to do with the Safe at Home program, which is a program that's been in existence for a number of years now. It's a pioneering program. Only a few states have it, but that list is growing. There are 226 participants in the program, and this enables victims of domestic abuse to have some degree of anonymity so that that their abusers can't find them and track them and know where they live. And it's been extraordinarily successful. And so we're proposing some modifications today, and members, I want to make this quick. I have an oral amendment. There was a written amendment in your packet, but as a result of some backroom negotiations here just before the hearing, I'm not going to offer that amendment, but I do have an oral amendment if I could do that. And maybe Mr. Gehring or someone could put it in writing if that's your pleasure.
Representative Simon, could you first tell us what it is?
Sure.
And we can decide.
Yeah. First, we're cutting out Section 3 and 4. So delete Section 3 and 4.
Okay.
Then on Section 1.
Well, I assume that as part of that, you're changing Section 5 to Section 3 then?
Yes.
That's automatic. Right. The reviser, I guess, I'm told, will take care of that. Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's a good point, Mr. Chair. Next, on line 1.19, and the word supersede, change the C to an S. And then delete the comma after the word ordinance and the word charter. And then on line 1.20, delete the words provision, comma, rule, comma, or other law.
Is that the end of it? Or still come.
And one more thing on that same line, line 1.20, please delete the words release or. And I can explain.
Is there any more?
That's all.
Representative Simon,
That's the end.
Can I go over this once more then? We'll delete Section 3 and 4, renumber Section 5 to Section 3.
Right.
On line 1.19, change the C in supersede to S, take out the comma after ordinance, take out charter. On line 120, take out provision, comma, rule, comma, or other law. And then at the end, release or.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. All in favor of the amendment to get in the shape? Oh. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Simon. You also want to change in line 3.19 section to 1. You can just delete that.
I get it.
Mr. Chair, I think the most effective way to fix the effective date is just to delete section 5 and insert this act is effective the day following final amendment.
Would that be a separate section then? Wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be.
Wouldn't it still be section 5 or section 3 now?
It'll be automatically fixed.
Okay, so we're not deleting this. We're just changing this act is effective. Did you say is effective?
Mr. Chair, it would be delete page 3, lines 19 and 20, and insert this act is effective the day following final enactment.
Right. So, don't you? Okay. Did Representative.
Yes.
Does anybody not understand that? Okay. Then all in favor of the amendment together and shape the authors, then say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Yeah, that's in the crowd, Representative Simon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. There's less here than meets the eye. Let me tell you what we just did, or more importantly, what the bill actually says now. Not what it did say, what it says. I think we can all agree with Section 2, which is that sex offenders should not be enrolled in the Safe at Home program. Everyone raise their hands and think sex offenders should be enrolled in the program. So I think we're okay there. I think that's utterly non-controversial. Now we're only dealing with Section 1. Section 3 is now just the enactment stuff. So Section 1 basically says, you know how on a lot of apartment buildings, on the front of the building, it says, you know, Mullery, apartment 2B. Well, we want to make sure that Safe at Home participants can escape that requirement so that you don't have to have your actual name and your apartment number on the front of the building, because that defeats the whole purpose of the program. That's what the bill does. That's it.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Maybe we can cut out the long testimony from Ms. Fraser.
I think we can't ever hear just to answer questions if there are any.
So we can go home tonight because she talks so long. Representative Westbrook.
Chair, brief question. So what does it do? Just allows the name Simon, but it doesn't say the apartment, or do you put a code up that says something else and somebody's supposed to know what's Simon? What
Representative,
no,
that's
more.
A fair question. You could still have the name up there and just have some other code. For instance, in some buildings, they have the name and then the dialing code that you're supposed to dial in order to get them. That could still happen, but it's not the actual apartment number.
Representative,
do you have a question? Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. About approximately how many women will this affect? In your estimation? Or
Mr. Chair?
I represent Simon.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Certainly it could affect, you know, as many people are in the program. So 200 some, over 200.
Okay, and what, if I could, Mr. Chair? What's the cost, estimated cost of this program?
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, there is no cost as far as I know.
Okay, then it's, I think we're ready to vote. Representative Johnson, was there any more discussion? No. Okay. All in favor of Representative Johnson's renewed motion to pass House File 1677 as amended to the General Register, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, can we do the 903 first? And I would move House File 903 and it goes to the General Register.
Representative Mullery moves House File 903 to the General Register. Go ahead with your bill, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Representative Johnson and members.
What this bill is about is back in 2004, I think it might have been Representative West at the time, before the witness was at the AG's office. We worked on the issue of foreclosure consultants that were ripping off people, and the legislature thought they had gotten at all of the abuses that were going on at the time, but now that people, some of them are not, some criminals unfortunately are pretty smart, so they found ways around the law, and so this bill is just closing some of the loopholes that they were using to escape from being covered by the law, and that's all it is. There's certain provisions under that law that people can't get paid until the end, and it just clarifies that, and then also says that you can't get around the argument that you're not working on a forbearance by saying you're negotiating terms of an existing mortgage. That also is covered by the law because people were escaping from it, and following the way this is done in the other committees, no committee wanted any more information, and so Natale, instead of testifying in the last committee, just was there for questions, which there weren't any. So if I don't think there hasn't been any opposition ever stated. If anybody...
Very good. Thank you, Representative Mulley. Members, are there any questions at this time? Seeing none, Representative Mulley renews his motion to move House File 903 to General Register. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mulley, on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And now I would move House File 19.
Chair Mulley,
to the General Register. I'm sorry.
Chair Mulley moves House File 19 to the General Register. To your bill, Chair Mulley.
Thank you, Madam. Mr. Chair. It's been a long week. Mr. Chair, this is actually one where in the last committee, several people said, how in the world did you get these people together and not argue? We came up with an issue on how to help mortgagors going through foreclosure and that would not harm the banks and lenders. And so since some of you, most of you weren't in commerce, but you heard Representative Davis and I talking about my expensive props for the, these are the expensive props that I used in commerce, which helped them understand the bill. I'll go through it real quickly. When you start a foreclosure, you will say this is the start of the foreclosure period. Then you have a sheriff's sale, which is about 4 months later. And then out here, you have a end of the redemption period, which is 6 months after the sheriff's sale. Between the start of the foreclosure and the sheriff's sale, you can, as a mortgagor, reinstate by just paying up the arrearages. After the sheriff's sale, during that 6 months, you have to pay up the total amount. So almost no mortgagor can ever do that unless they have a rich uncle that dies or something, gives them $1 million. What we're doing is, at the option of the mortgagor, they can move this date out 5 months, but there's only a 5 week redemption period, just like on other types of certain types of abandoned property. And so they can reinstate if they are out of work for 3 months, either because of layoffs or also maybe got sick. They have time to earn the arrearages and pay it off, or longer time to get some money saved up to pay that off in the meantime, so that many more mortgages will be reinstated. And the fact is that the lenders are not against it because it doesn't extend the time that they get it back, and there's also the advantage to lenders that any reputable lender wants the mortgage paid. They don't want the houses back, and it's even more so now with the glut of properties they have. So the lenders have no property or no opposition to this. They did request two things, and I told them that we would put it in. One is just
to right now, the way it was written by the Bar Association was that the affidavit postponement would be sent to Sheriff Solander's ask that they get a copy. I'm sure that'll be okay. And the other one's just about the same type of thing. So we just haven't had time to clear that with the Bar Association. I told the lenders we would do that when it got to the floor with those two technical changes. So that's the bill, and we haven't had any questions or opposition anywhere in the other committee.
Very good. Thank you, Chair Mulry. Members, any questions at this time? Anyone from the audience wish to speak for them? Seeing none, Representative Mulry or Chair Mulry renews his motion to move House File 19 to the General Register. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Seeing none, motion prevails and the bill is off General Register.
Representative Murphy.
Somebody wants to move the bill. Representative Hortman moves House File 454, and does this go to the floor or finance? No, finance. Just to the General Register? Okay, Representative Murphy, go ahead and present your bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Happy deadline day. I'd like to begin by introducing Lois Mizek, who's the Executive Director for Project 515, and we'd like to begin there and then work on this.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'll be brief. My name is Lois Mizek. I'm Executive Director of Project 515. Project 515 did a research project several years ago and identified 515 statutes in Minnesota that discriminate against same-sex couples and their families, hence our name. We are a focused initiative with a specific achievable goal, which is to ensure that same-sex couples and their families have equal rights and considerations under Minnesota law. The piece of legislation that we're presenting today affects couples at the time of death, and a number of the statutes that we are actually bringing forth in this session address time of death with same-sex couples and the inability of couples to actually determine what happens in this particular bill with the remains of their partner. So I'll let Representative Murphy talk a little bit about the statute.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And, you know, I want to begin with recognizing that we probably have all dealt with the death of a loved one. And from my perspective, the last things that we do as we go through that process of determining those last wishes is sort of a sacred process. It's the last thing we do for that loved one. And I know when I did that with my mother how important it was for us to get that right. And I think that the laws in Minnesota right now are closing an eye to some of the families in Minnesota, and I think we need to right that wrong. And House File 454 has that as its intention. Under current Minnesota law, married couples have the automatic right to carry out the final wishes of deceased spouses. However, domestic partners receive no similar right under law. And in fact, often domestic partners will try and replicate this right by drawing up legal documents, and the documents are costly. They often fail to guarantee the rights, and they're sometimes ignored. The Final Wishes Bill provides domestic partners the same right as married spouses to carry out the final wishes of their partners. This legislation eliminates one of 515 discriminatory laws, yielding more fairness and compassion in Minnesota statutes, and I urge your support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm a very strong supporter of the objectives of Project 515 and this legislation and the other legislation that's like it. And I think the reason we need to fix things is we have an equal protection problem with the way the laws are currently written. And I would propose an amendment, and I don't think it harms the intent or the effect of the language. I just think it avoids an equal protection problem running the other way. And that would be to propose to delete line 2.13 and then renumber the subdivisions under C to reflect the deletion of number 1. And the reason for this, members, is my understanding is that there are a lot of elderly couples who cohabitate and make their lives together, but they don't marry for reasons of not wanting to alter inheritance issues with their children or Social Security payments. And I think what this would do is it would recognize that there may be situations where those individuals are denied the right to care for their loved one in those final arrangements also.
Any discussion or Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, members, 2 years ago I worked on another similar piece of legislation dealing with hospital visitation, and in the Health Committee we did a similar thing, recognizing that there are situations just like Representative Portman is describing that extend outside of same-sex couples, and so I would support this amendment.
Is there any opposition to this amendment? Okay, the amendment is on page 2, delete line 13 and correct the internal references. Our council has indicated that's the way to handle it. So, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Representative Murphy. Is there any discussion of the bill as amended? Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, to the author, what stops a situation like you're explaining? They have a valid will in place and specify it in there, and their partner has the right to be the personal representative. Would that cover what you're talking, or is there other documents that they need to sign in order to be able to have this permission?
Mr. Chair and Representative Weston, unfortunately, one of our witnesses was unable to be with us today. Tim Reardon came and testified in the Health Committee on this point, and he did go through, he and his partner went through the process of signing a number of legal documents to try and affect what is the same right. Using a number of legal documents, and there was one box in one of the documents that they missed, and as a result, his partner's express wishes were ignored, and they had to default to the next of kin, his family, to make the final decisions about his partner's remains. So I think that unmarried couples are trying to affect the same rights that married couples have as a result of marriage, but they're often expensive, they're sometimes in error, and they're sometimes ignored. And so I think it is right for us to think about fixing the statute instead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have actually 3 examples in Minnesota that happened over the past year of couples that have been together over 16 years. Where the intention of the relationship was not followed through when it came to the disposition of the final remains. One of them was about a gentleman who actually died in a parking lot in Minneapolis. The next of kin was his sister in Duluth, although he had a partner for 16 years, and documentation showing that it still was not enough to allow this process to end up in the hands of the surviving partner. What we're trying to do is assure that couples, I would guess even in this room that very few of us have a document saying what we want to have happen to our remains, so that it would be a process that would happen automatically, that it would not have to be something that those of us who are in the youthful stages of our life have to actually have a document sitting at home saying what we want to have happen to our remains. So it's trying to kind of create an equal plane around that without having to have the intentional document ahead of time.
Okay, next I'm going to ask for Mr. Pritchard, I believe, wants to speak on this. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak? Okay, Mr. Pritchard, would you come up? Then we can finish the question. Go ahead, Mr. Pritchard.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we would oppose this legislation for a few reasons. First of all, I think this, just from a policy standpoint, injects greater complexity in the law. If you look under the current law, it allows a person or persons appointed in a dated written instrument signed by the decedent. So all you have to do is have a written document. but you're now creating a status, domestic detainer status, which is pretty vague as to, you know, multiple steps, multiple elements that I think probably could open up to greater litigation than just having somebody simply sign a written document. So I think that's one issue. As far as the establishment of domestic partner status, I think this is really unfair. It's discriminatory on one level, because it doesn't include other people. You know, if you're trying to define it in terms of people who care for one another, you've got adult siblings, grandparents, adult children, other individuals who are specifically excluded. Why would you do that if you're trying to embrace a broader range of people? And also, what you're doing is you're giving a benefit or a legal recognition to a group which doesn't have the attendant legal responsibilities, and that's one of the reasons, from a general policy standpoint, we oppose domestic partner statuses, because you're basically it's an unfairness to married couples, which, you know, whether it's for health benefits or other things, are giving them legal rights but not the attendant responsibilities. So for those reasons, we oppose this effort to create a status for domestic partners. And this specific bill, we just don't think it's really necessary. All you have to do is sign a written document. Thank you.
Representative Scott Smith.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Doesn't this bill just really further elevate domestic partnerships to be the next step towards authorizing the same-sex marriage?
Representative Murphy, just quite a few steps in between. Is the very next step gay marriage? I thought the next step.
I said, isn't it one of the next steps?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, it's a good question, and I think given that there were, I think, bills contemplated for today's schedule that were removed, represents where we are as Minnesotans. I think Minnesotans are engaging in a discussion about that, but I don't think that discussion is right yet. I think it's going to take Minnesotans time. I don't see this bill as a step in that direction. I think this bill is one of 515 ways that we have to recognize that current Minnesota statutes discriminate against certain Minnesotans, and we should resolve that separate from the discussion that's going on in Minnesota about the issue that you raised. But they're separate discussions.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, I heard your testifier talk about couples. Where in your bill does it limit this to two people?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that's a fine question.
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy, I think on line 2.20 after the end may deal with that.
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Westrom, I guess.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question was similar to Representative Scott's, but let me take it one step further. It does seem like this basically is a step in that direction. Obviously, it's not sanctioning gay marriage or same-sex marriage, which is an issue we've spent a lot of time on here, but I guess maybe Mr. Preacher would be the guy I would want to ask this to, but Representative Murphy, I mean, one concern I would have is once this is in the law, it becomes similar to the seatbelt violation law that we have thankfully opposed in the House. But once you move the current status of the law closer, you don't hear the arguments anymore in that the seatbelt scenario, and let me just use that for an illustration, about whether we should have the law or not. It's, well, should we allow a cop to pull you over or not? If you go back 20 years ago when the secondary offense law was being debated, that was vigorously opposed. And the compromise was, okay, well, we'll just make it a secondary offense. We aren't looking for primary seat belts. We just want it to be an offense, and if a cop pulls you over, it's a violation they can cite you for. Well, it wasn't but 6-8 years later, and they were back for a primary offense, and all of a sudden the line of scrimmage had moved because they weren't debating anymore whether or not the law gives them this right in statutes. All of a sudden the statutes are being used as an argument for why we should move the next step. And so I think to Representative Scott's question, I think she raises a very good point, and I would just ask for you and Mr. Preacher to respond to that. How does it not move us closer by sanctioning this in statute, and then in the years to come, I can just about bet someone's going to be using this and pointing to this as our laws already allow this type of revision. We've already considered that. Why not make the next steps to same-sex marriage recognition?
Mr. Pritchard.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Weston. I think you raised exactly the right point. We've seen in other jurisdictions where they do get domestic partner status, which is really marriage by another name, into the law. And they've used that as a grounds for going into court and suing and challenging marriage laws. And in some cases, they've been successful doing that. So I think that is ultimately our concern. Is I think this is clearly a stepping stone in an effort to get into law marriage type status and then open up the courts for legal challenges. So that you know, that gets back to the basic issue of why do we have marriage between a man and a woman? I think the state's primary interest is the well-being of children and creating and encouraging an environment for the raising of children. And, you know, children need a mother and a father. So, I mean, that's the fundamental policy reason for giving marital status to a man and a woman, not to same-sex couples or multiple individuals.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative...
Representative Murphy, does she have a response to that?
Oh, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that as policymakers, we have to be able to discern the difference in motivations behind pieces of policy. This legislation is about attacking one of the discriminatory statutes in Minnesota law, and we should not let our fear about a possible slippery slope block us from making sure that families and citizens have equal protection under the law.
Okay, Representative Hortman renews her motion to pass House File 454 to the general, as amended, right, to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
Carries.
Representative Morrow, are you ready to go? And I think there's been an agreement.
Mr. So Chair, did that fail?
No, I said carries.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Representative Morrow, there's an agreement, I believe, on a certain term that we're trying to eyeing up. Okay, then we'll take you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tamar moves House File 1639. Is that correct, Representative Morrow? And do you have an amendment? Number 276, is that your amendment?
Yes,
okay. So Representative Tamar moves amendment 276 to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this is an agency bill regarding the operations of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, one location in St. Peter, and you'll see one of the provisions deals with escape from one of the new programs being resident in St. Peter. Certainly understand my community's concerns, making sure that the agency has the authority to apprehend escapees from this newer program. The amendment is an agreed-upon amendment, members. We've worked with the department changing the term from the department had originally wanted to change the term from patient to client. The amendment throughout changes it from patient to civilly committed sex offender. And with that, I'll turn to Dennis Dan Storkamp and also to Dennis Benson to talk about particulars of the bill. So,
Dennis Storkamp.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Storkamp, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I'd walk through each section fairly quickly, given the interest of time. Section 1 allows...
Storkamp, can you do it real quickly? Not even... I don't think there's... I think Representative Morrow has reached an agreement with everybody, and so maybe... Is there anybody from the audience who wants to speak on this? Anybody on the committee want to speak on it? I hate to tell you, Mr. Storkamp and Mr. Benson, but I think we can go ahead on this one. You're only going to go down... Oh, Representative Kamar.
A minute explanation of what the bill does before I vote on it.
Oh, okay. Representative Morrow? Or... Representative Storkamp?
Mr. Chair and members of...
Not Representative, I demeaned you again, but Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair and members, very quickly, there are six components to this bill. These are agency bill and agency operational changes. Section 1 allows state agencies to purchase from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program and a vocational work program without going out to solicitation for a small number of components, and this is similar to what the Minnesota Department of Corrections has for MnCOR. And the Department of Admin, the MMD, is reviewed in support of this. Section 2 allows seven cars that MSLP Special Investigation Unit has to be unmarked license plates. This is a provision that allows, we've got temporary approval currently from Department of Motor Vehicles, and they have reviewed and approved this as long as it's for special investigative purposes. Section 3 through 6, really a definitional change. Representative Morrow talked about the client definition now changed to the civilly committed sex offender as opposed to just patient. We are have a new non-secure facility for our community preparation service. This is the first step before they're provisionally discharged. We've got two individuals in that program, and we're defining that as we separate from the state operated services. Clarifies executive director as well as it defines the Minnesota Sex Offender Program completely, not just a secure program, but what we do as far as hold, secure environment, as well as our CPS program and our early, our provisional discharge process. Section 7 provides for an external review of the program for treatment purposes. This is done by outside experts, as this is a relatively new field, only 20 states in the nation that have this. We are bringing in the experts to help on the clinical side of a review to help us determine the direction. And it also provides in statute that we have to have a policy that, around our grievance process for our patients. Sections 8 and 9 deal with our vocational work program. The two key pieces here, one, we are putting language in, so this is a vocational work program for our patients, not that they're employees. In addition, it clarifies that 50% of the pay is to be reimbursed to the program, and the other 50% in current statute could be interpreted that our proceeds have to go back to the client. In the change that we're providing, that 50% really goes back to the patient, not any of our proceeds. In addition, it covers all clients, not just those in our industry or shop program, but also those that have a unit work program as well. And then Sections 10 and 11, as Representative Morrow has talked about, is our escape and clarification that if they move from a secure environment to our CPS program or ultimately to provisional discharge, it carries with it the same ability for us to put in a warrant out, bring the person back, and work with local law enforcement.
Okay, thank you. Unless there's further discussion, Representative Tamar?
Representative Morrow, I just have another place to go.
Representative Morrow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tamar, my understanding is it would go to the General Register That's at this name. Point.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, I would just ask you to go through the bill again and just make sure that your amendment changes all of the things that you wanted to change, because I noticed that on page 6, line 29, you still have clients on there. I don't know how many, I didn't read it that carefully, but I don't know how many other places there might be that have it amended civilly.
Representative Morrow, isn't that something you agreed to take care of?
I can go back to it. I will say on the amendment line 1.7, page 6, line 29 is changed.
But maybe I'm missing one that... I would be happy to go back through the bill one more time, and if I'm missing a client amendment.
Page 6, line 29, it looks like the resolved client concerns, but...
Yes, and Representative Paymore, on line 1.7 of the amendment, page 6, line 29, is included as one of the changes.
I don't have that in mind. So I don't have that. Okay, you can show me later.
Right. Page 6, line 29 is on line 1.7 of the amendment. Maybe you could help them.
Okay.
Right.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Paymar renews his motion to send House File 1639 as amended to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Should we do... Okay. Representative Emmer, House File 176. Does anybody want to move that?
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to move House File 176.
Representative Fulberg moves House File 176. And does this goes to finance? Or, yeah, to finance. Okay, Representative Emmer, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thanks for hearing this bill. House File 176, you're going to hear testimony depending on the chair's discretion as to how you want to handle this. You would hear testimony about a specific case, but I want to start off by making it very clear to everybody on the committee, this really has nothing to do with that case. What this bill does is this allows a remedy for someone or a family, for instance, that believes that a medical examiner's determination of the cause of death is incorrect. It would give them a remedy to challenge that if they deem necessary. What started this is a case of a Minneapolis police officer who died several years ago, and his mother, Mary Heft, is here, and if necessary, she will testify and tell you about that story, where the family received a determination of death on the death certificate from the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office. They had another medical examiner from Anoka give a different opinion. The Hennepin County Medical Examiner, who is here, Dr. Andrew Baker, is the current Hennepin County Medical Examiner. They did, if he testifies, he would tell you, they did all kinds of internal peer reviews that reaffirmed their determination. So why do I tell you all this? Because that was a difference of opinion that actually went to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals said to the family, you do not have a remedy. Your remedy is with the legislature. Over the summer, the attorney that handled this case came to me and said, even though it would do nothing or have no bearing on this case, we believe there should be a remedy. And that's why we brought the bill forward. Now, procedurally, this bill was heard in Representative Thiessen's Healthcare Policy Committee. As a practicing lawyer and familiar with the way our courts review and balance causation determinations, expert opinions, I guess I didn't see a problem. I thought our system was based on people should have due process. People should have a remedy. And I felt the court system was appropriate. So the way this was drafted, we had the hearing in the Health Committee, Policy Committee, and it passed unanimously. The next day, Dr. Baker was in my office explaining to me why I was wrong. And I apologized to Dr. Baker. I really should have contacted his office beforehand. We pulled the bill back at that point because it was not right to proceed with it. And we had another hearing in the Health Policy Committee where all interested parties testified. I'm giving you a lot of background, but here's the result. We didn't know how this was going to, whether it was going to pass or not out of the Health Policy Committee. In the end, it did pass unanimously with the committee recommending, and specifically, I've got an amendment that I'm going to offer from Representative Liebling. Specifically, the issue was the remedy. Again, I want to make sure, because if the chair allows it and we have the testimony,
I do hope the committee will keep in mind it is not about that case. That is just background as to how we got here. This is not personal. Nobody's challenging somebody's competency. You will hear evidence that in states that allow this, and I believe you're going to hear Ohio, Wisconsin, and maybe one other, that allow for this remedy. Since 1958, there have been 13 challenges, 13 cases. You may hear that in those states they allow other than medical examiner to make a determination on the cause of death, and that's why they allow the challenge. But that should actually raise a red flag with you. If there have only been 13 challenges when you allow other experts or doctors to make causation determinations, you would expect that you would have more challenges, but you've only had 13. You will hear from the Department of Health that they've already got this in their rules. They've had a rule for the last decade that would provide, upon court order, they would change a death certificate. And I'm just going to expand on that, Mr. Chair, and then I'll be done with the preliminary comments. This would not change the death certificate, so the original would never exist. My understanding is that there would be, you would see both. You would see the original determination and then the amendment. Now, Mr. Chair, you had suggested when we talked about a remedy that would go through the Department of Health, and I have drafted that amendment or had that amendment drafted, but I've also had the other one drafted, which is titled the A4 amendment, and if I might very briefly explain to you why, and we do have someone from the Department of Health who can explain it. The Department of Health first does
Representative Emmer, just a second. You've explained the general idea for the bill. You don't have which way you'd like to go, whether it's the A4 or the A3.
I do. I would prefer to move the A4, and I was going to explain to you why.
Okay. Let's move the A4 to get it. You want that to get it in the shape that you want the bill in. Is that my understanding?
I do, sir.
Mr. Chair, let's
okay,
move
you
A4.
Can't move the bill, but A4, Representative Holberg would move the A4 then. All in favor of the A4 amendment, just to get it in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, now it's in the shape you want. Maybe you should explain that amendment as part of the bill, and you could also explain the alternative A3 in case anybody may prefer that.
Thank you. First, the amendment that was just added to the bill is styled after the affidavit of expert review, which the legislature passed into law several years ago, having to do with professional negligence cases. In this state, in order for you to proceed with a claim of professional negligence, you must present an expert's opinion, a qualified, competent expert's opinion that would be accepted by the court before you can even proceed. And I checked, and I don't know if Mr. Carlson's here, but I checked. In the state of Minnesota, annually, out of 5 million residents, with this provision in our law, we only have 150 professional malpractice cases, medical malpractice cases, filed a year out of 5 million people. If you take a look, it also provides in the last sentence that in this case, if somebody truly believed that the medical examiner had made a mistake, that the opinion was wrong, it would require them not only to provide the affidavit of expert review, which would be a qualified, competent expert recognized by the court, but if you take a look at that last sentence, the standard's going to be extremely high. It would require that the evidence be clear, the standard be by clear and convincing evidence. With that, Mr. Chair, that is the bill. Now, I'll save my final remarks after it's done. I leave it to the chair's pleasure as to how you would like to...
Well, what we're going to have is, I know there's opposition to the
right.
bill, so we're going to hear from them. You mentioned the department. Is there somebody from the department would also be...
I do. I have somebody from the lawyer's office that can tell you about the case if you want to hear it. Otherwise,
no,
I have the department.
I'm more interested in the issue not hearing about one case.
Thank
you.
At
this part, do you want the person from the department to come up? Okay.
Why don't we do that? He can also explain to you why we didn't adopt the other amendment.
Sure. Just Representative Hortman, did you have something
to the office?
Before the department? Yes. Okay, Representative Hortman.
Representative Emmer, you said this wasn't about a specific case, and I just wondered if you are going to be moving to delete lines 1.6 and 1.7, if that's the case.
That would, Representative Emmer, I think that would help it.
Oh, and I apologize. I'm looking at my original bill. That might be as amended because in that first, Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, in the first committee hearing before everyone testified, the committee moved 1.6, you say?
Right, 1.6 and 1.7.
Oh, yeah, that's
fine. Up the bill.
That's fine. Absolutely. If that's what you want to move, I'm fine.
Representative Portman moved.
No, I'm not going to move that at this point. I just want to ask the question.
Right.
Okay. Representative Rimmer, do you want to move that?
I can't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Holbert.
Chair, I'd be happy to move.
Representative Holbert moves the deletion of lines 1.6 and 1.7. I think it's self-explanatory. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Carried.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Mr. Chair, Jim Golden, the director of
Golden?
Policy. Golden.
Golden. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, I think the department is here primarily to answer questions. One thing that might be just important to note for the committee is to understand the role of the Department of Health and the State Registrar as it relates to death records. We are the recorder of the fact, and we are responsible for recording what comes in. So when there is a death certificate, whether it is filed by a physician or a medical examiner or a coroner, or ultimately if we get a court order, what we do with that is we simply change the system in response to their expertise as to what the issues with the death certificate are. We don't actually make those determinations. We simply record it and then make sure that the death certificates are accurate with regard to the people who have already determined the facts. So from that standpoint, I would just say that the difference between the A4 and the A3 amendment is with regard to the A3 amendment, which I know you're not considering at the moment, that would seemingly place a responsibility on the state registrar that goes beyond simply recording the facts and actually starts to get into determining those, and that is a role that we don't currently do today.
But I have a question, Mr. Gold. Isn't that a type of thing that many administrative agencies do? They make determinations of issues within their agency's realm. Or maybe you're not familiar with administrative processes here on hearings. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, I think with regard to that, what the state registrar does is just register birth and death and then make sure that those identity documents and official records are accurate. And I think there has been a long history of how the information that is on those records is determined. For example, in births, it's with the hospitals, and there's a variety of ways of doing that when there's a birth outside of the hospital. With regard to death, there are very elaborate processes with regard to registering a death within the system, clarifying that information, including cause of death, that it is from a physician or a medical examiner or coroner. And I think what our responsibility is primarily is to ensure that the process has been followed, not to actually determine what is the correct information, other than if it's been through the correct process.
I see what you're saying. You don't, in the past at least, unless something is done here, you don't get into whether that's accurate. You just register what comes to you under the present law.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Then I know there's opposition. Does anybody in the room oppose it? I had heard there was. Apparently there is. There somebody opposing this? Okay. Do you all want to come up at once? Okay.
I did.
Would you state your name and position?
My name is Andrew Baker. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I am a board-certified forensic pathologist, and I have 11 years of experience in death investigation. I am the chief ethical examiner for Hennepin County. That is a position that I've held since 2004. I actively publish articles and regularly teach at medical and forensic science meetings at the local, state, and national level. And I also hold teaching appointments at the University of Minnesota and at the Hennepin County Medical Center. While the family in this case has my ongoing and deepest sympathy for the loss of their son in 2001, as a physician, as a medical examiner, and as a forensic scientist, I feel compelled to tell you why I think HF-176 is ill-advised. Ascertaining the cause and manner of death for cases where the manner is other than natural in the state of Minnesota is statutorily defined as the province of the independent coroner or medical examiner. Under Minnesota law, the coroner must be a licensed physician. Thus, the coroner has 4 years of medical school and at least three years of postgraduate training, much of which involves a strong background in science. Medical examiners in the state of Minnesota must be trained forensic pathologists, meaning that they have 4 years of medical school, 3 to 5 years of residency training, plus an additional year of training in forensic pathology. The qualifications to become a medical examiner or a coroner in the state of Minnesota are significantly more stringent than they are in many other states, where the coroner may be a layperson with little or no formal training in death investigation. Families regularly contact the coroner's and medical examiner's office asking that we change a variety of things such as suicide or alcohol use or drug intoxication or autoerotic asphyxia or a variety of other things they find unpalatable on the death certificate. Each and every time a family wants a judge or a panel to overturn a death certificate under this proposed legislation, the financial and resource repercussions would include the medical examiner or coroner being pulled away from his or her job, the medical examiner or coroner asking the county attorney's office to represent them, and the case consuming more of the courts and the state's time and money. This last point would seem especially noteworthy at a time when funding is being drastically reduced and local governments are struggling to keep up with the demands of their existing workload. Medical examiners and coroners in the state of Minnesota do not have unchecked power. Medical examiners, and this is myself included, are appointed by their elected county commissioners, and we are accountable to the public. Coroners are directly elected or appointed by their county boards, and therefore are also accountable to the public. Rogue coroners and medical examiners who regularly refuse to even listen to their citizens can be voted out of office or not get reappointed or be removed by their county boards when cause is shown. I am somewhat doubtful about assurances that this legislation would be used very little. Families are rarely, if ever, pleased about having something they consider negative on a death certificate. What prevents every single one of these families from using this legislation if it passes? In fact, if I read the legislation correctly, it's not even families that have to bring one of these suits. What's to prevent the police from using this legislation to alter the medical examiner's opinion, or the press, or the county attorney, or criminal defendants? Any one of these people could ask for a panel or a judge to overturn a death certificate. Let me emphasize that coroners and medical examiners are not recalcitrant, uncaring, faithless government officials. In the state of Minnesota, we are all physicians, and we listen to the calls and concerns of the citizens in the counties that we serve. Coroners and medical examiners can and regularly do change death certificates when new, significant, and verifiable information is brought to our attention. We already seek the opinions of our partners and outside consultants when warranted. What you might refer to in the legal community as due process, we in the scientific and medical community refer to as quality assurance and peer review. And no death certificate is ever set in stone. I have amended death certificates that are more than 20 years old, and just last week I amended a death certificate. If any family in the state of Minnesota were forced to deal with a medical examiner who is simply unwilling to listen or unwilling to even revisit a case, let alone entertain a second opinion, I could easily understand why turning the case over to the courts and seeking a legal remedy might seem to be in order. And depending on what you think you know about this case, you might think that this family should have a judge making the diagnosis on their family's death certificate. Now this case, I understand this testimony today is no longer about one case, but if I understand Representative Emmer correctly, the real question on the table is, what remedy do families have when they disagree with a death certificate? It would be somewhat instructive for you to know how we got to this point. The case that brought this legislation before you was initially reviewed by four board-certified forensic pathologists with collectively more than 50 years of experience in death investigation. The then chief medical examiner of Hennepin County, Gary Peterson, knew that the high-profile nature of this case, combined with the fact that it was a police officer's death and the resistance of the family, justified the time and apparent expense of garnering even more expertise.
Dr. Peterson asked not one, but two out-of-state chief medical examiners from jurisdictions much larger than ours to review the case honestly and independently. Both of these outside offices agreed that the case was a suicide and that the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's investigation warranted that conclusion. Before this case was even certified on a Minnesota death certificate, it had already been reviewed by six board-certified forensic pathologists in three different states. The family came across a medical examiner who devised a way to illustrate her hypothesis that the case might be an accident. She videotaped her illustration. This was presented to the entire medical staff of the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's office. Even though not one physician in that office found the illustration plausible or containing new or verifiable data, Dr. Peterson again agreed to send the entire case, including this illustration, to the out-of-state chief medical examiners in jurisdictions much larger than ours. Again, both of these outside consultants confirmed that the death was a suicide. After thoroughly and independently reviewing the case as the newest member of the office and as the newly appointed chief medical examiner when Dr. Peterson retired in 2004, I also concluded that the death was a suicide. If the family's one medical expert formally vetted the case with even one peer from the medical examiner community, that would be news to the medical examiner's office of Hennepin County. I bring all this up because the essence of this bill is to state that the medical examiner simply has not done enough to thoroughly scrutinize the case. The family has not received due process. You, the medical examiner, need to do more. Because a family cannot and will not abide what the fully trained and duly appointed medical examiner has placed on a death certificate, the legislature must take that responsibility out of the hands of the experts and place it in the hands of a judge. Again, let me emphasize, the Hennepin County Medical Examiner had this case fully reviewed twice by no fewer than seven board-certified forensic pathologists in three different states. In my 11 years of practice, I cannot recall a single non-homicide case that came even close to this level and breadth of review. If this level of medical examiner time and resource is now considered inadequate, then what exactly would be adequate? After all the time, money, and expertise brought to bear on one case, are we then to go to the additional financial burden of defending the diagnosis in a courtroom and letting the medical determination of cause and manner of death rest in the hands of a judge? Where would we get the time and the money and the resources to continue this? If every family who is unhappy about a suicide, alcoholism, drug use, or anything else they find objectionable on a death certificate is legally entitled to as much time and attention as this case has already received, and that's still deemed inadequate by our legislature, exactly where would we get the time and resources to review these cases again and again and again and again? My office alone could have performed dozens of autopsies for families that would have wanted them and provided days of testimony to the courts and defendants that need it, instead of again and again trying to help a family come to grips with something they will never find acceptable. In conclusion, the cause and manner of death opinions are not just opinions in the colloquial sense of the word. They are medical diagnoses made by licensed and highly trained physicians in the state of Minnesota. Taking one family and broadly translating its dissatisfaction into law merely substitutes advocacy for science, and the result is bad medicine and bad public policy. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question of the Justice?
Thank you. Doctor, in your testimony, you stated that because this particular case was high profile and involved a police officer, that all these steps were taken. My understanding it's not about this case, but moving forward, can you tell me what type of, I mean, not, if you're just Joe Blow Minnesota citizen, I'm assuming that you would recognize that there is a possibility for bad actors even in your profession. What, under current law, is the recourse or the remedy for somebody who doesn't have a high-profile case, nobody wants to take a second look at it? What rights do individuals have if they disagree with what's put on the death record?
Mr. Baker. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for that question. So far as I know, there is nothing specifically defined in the statutes as a right to do what you just described. So let me tell you how it works in my office. When a family calls me and they're concerned about what's on a death certificate, they talk to the physician who signed that, and the physician is more than happy to explain the reasons for doing that. If the family is still unhappy with that, then the family is given my direct office line, and they are more than welcome to talk to me, or even to come down to downtown Minneapolis and talk to me in person about the case. If the family has new information that would actually shed new light or cast a new perspective on the case, we are always happy to hear them out in person, by telephone, or in writing. Again, no death certificate is set in stone. No medical examiner in Minnesota that I know is so recalcitrant that they would refuse to read the letters or take the phone calls of families. When I speak to the public, I always emphasize that my first constituents are the families of the decedents that come through our morgue. And we are always happy to listen to and entertain new information that comes to light. As I mentioned earlier, just last week, I removed something on a death certificate that a family found objectionable because they provided very good reasons that it shouldn't be on there. And going back and reviewing some investigative information that hadn't been available to me the first time, it was clear that the family had a valid point. And I did amend the death certificate.
And Mr. Chair, you know, from your testimony, you've convinced me you're a good actor and you have a good, responsible department. But with 87 counties, there is the possibility that those protocols aren't followed somewhere else in the state. We, as a state, end up looking at legislation not because the people are doing things well, but because of problems. So do you have any recommendation for us as legislators if this is not the answer? What is the answer to have oversight or recourse for bad actors in your field?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's also a very excellent question. My suggestion would be if you are a citizen in a county and your medical examiner is utterly recalcitrant and your coroner simply won't even take your phone calls or listen to what you have to say or won't even review the case even once, vote that coroner out of office. It's an elected position. If you have an appointed medical examiner, go to your county board with the documentation and say, look, this person hasn't even opened the letters we sent in. They refuse to take even one phone call from us. We have new information they won't even look at. Don't let that medical examiner get reappointed. I don't think taking medical diagnoses and handing them to judges is the best solution.
And Mr. Chair, I agree with that, but I also agree that the average voter doesn't have the breadth of knowledge in the medical field to ascertain if he said, she said, on an issue as complex as this. I mean, I think there should be some type of peer review process or, you know, there should be some checks and balances on an even playing field, just saying get somebody else to run against or, you know, take it to the political process doesn't get at the information that I think the public deserves on whether or not the individual that holds the position is actually ethical and competent in their work. And then we need more than just voters to be able to ascertain that.
Mr. Kingery? Are we?
I'm next. Thank you.
Oh, you've got an order? Okay. State your name.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. My name is Dr. Lindsay Thomas. I'm a licensed physician and have been a board-certified forensic pathologist for 20 years. I am the medical examiner for Carver, Chisago, Dakota, Fillmore, Freeborn, Goodhue, Houston, and Scott counties. I also want to offer my condolences to Ryan's family. For those of us who have thankfully not experienced the tragedy of a child's death, I recognize that there's no way we can know what it must feel like, but I'm sure there is no greater pain. I'm testifying today on behalf of coroners and medical examiners, as well as on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association. I agree with everything that Dr. Baker has said, and I would like to add just a few more comments. This bill does not provide guidance regarding the process to follow in order for a judge to consider the issue. Absent such guidance, a family's attorney might attempt to go to a judge, even without any notice to the coroner, medical examiner, or physician who signed the death certificate. The system we have now allows each family in Minnesota equal access to having their disputed death certificate reviewed by the coroner or medical examiner. If this bill is enacted, only families with financial resources, connections, influence, or legal knowledge are likely to pursue this extreme measure of going to court. This does not make our system more fair. With respect to this bill, so far we have primarily discussed death certificates signed by coroners and medical examiners who can be represented by county attorneys in court. But the majority of death certificates in the state are signed by clinical physicians, family doctors, internists, and surgeons. County attorneys will not represent them in court when families object to their putting alcoholic liver disease or AIDS or complications of drug abuse on death certificates. Doctors will not be willing to risk being pulled out of the clinic or the operating room simply to go to court to defend the cause of death
and the validity of death certificates and subsequent public health data may suffer. As far as the other states that do have a law like this, they are states that have lay coroners, that is, coroners who are not forensic pathologists, or in most cases not even physicians, such as in Wisconsin. I have heard from colleagues in Ohio, which has such a law, that there have been attempts to use this law by defendants and people convicted of murders on the theory that if they get the death certificate changed from homicide, then they are not responsible for the death. While I assume these efforts are ultimately not successful, they do tie up lawyers and court time. In conclusion, despite the very good intentions of this bill's author, it does nothing to improve the quality of death certification in Minnesota and risks the loss of valuable public health information. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I would ask that this committee vote to not pass the bill on to the House.
Mr. Kingery, are you going to speak?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. My name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Last week, our Civil Law Committee had the opportunity to review the bill as introduced, and last Friday, our Board of Directors voted to oppose this legislation. It's my belief that even with this amendment, and I appreciate the author moving forward and trying to forge a middle ground, and at some point there may be, I don't know. We do appreciate his efforts, but I believe that the association and our members would still oppose this legislation as drafted. Just a couple of very quick points. Again, determinations regarding the cause of death are medical determinations and diagnoses and should not be replaced with a judicial opinion. We've all heard about the courts and how they're at the breaking point, and we don't need the Chief Justice to write in and tell us how they are just simply strapped, and they do not need additional issues and cases to tie up their particular time. As was stated earlier, if the medical examiner or coroner is pulled away from their job in the court, we're going to be there representing them, unless it's a private family physician, and it's certainly going to tie up additional court time. And again, this will have a disparate impact with regard to the poor and the indigent that would not be able to use this particular process. Again, the process, we believe, bill is a bad precedent. If we're going to now look at a judicial proceeding with regard to death certificates, what's next? Medical records? I think this belongs in the hands of the physicians who are trained to make these decisions. Again, the impact on criminal cases, we're very concerned about that, where an individual could go in and get a modification to a death certificate and could possibly change the outcome of that case. Or if the person's already been convicted and they're in prison, we frequently see post-conviction appeals. And I could see one in this case where they would go in and attempt to get it amended. The one thing I'd like to just comment on, in reviewing the court's decision in this particular case, the court noted that the Government Data Practices Act allows for challenges to the accuracy or completeness of certain types of data. And the court has interpreted the Government Data Practices Act to allow correction of conclusions contained in the disputed data that are determined to be inaccurate. However, that issue was not raised on appeal, and therefore they expressed no opinion on its application. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
I'd like to invite Brandon Schwartz down. There have been some statements made about anecdotal people in Ohio doing things. There are specific facts that I think the committee should hear about the actual challenges in other states, if you'd allow it.
Representative Emmer. What would he have?
Brandon Schwartz, his father, Mike Schwartz, was the attorney that took the case that Mr. Kingery just referred to all the way to the Court of Appeals. Mr. Schwartz is actually working out of state. Brandon worked on the case as a student at William Mitchell. He testified at the Health Policy Committee as well.
Okay. A very short testimony then.
Yeah, I believe so.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brandon Schwartz, and like Mr. Emmer said, I worked on this case from the beginning, And although there are some inaccuracies in Dr. Baker's statement as it relates to this case, like we said before, this is about all Minnesotans. This isn't just about the Hecks and the wrong that's been done to them. First of all, Dr. Baker and his colleagues attempt to say that there's going to be a slippery slope and that there's going to be a huge amount of cases that's going to be brought under this. Well, in Ohio, since they enacted this statute, there's been 13 since 1958. In Wisconsin, there's been 2 since 1985. And like Mr. Emmer said at the beginning of this, these are states that the medical examiners are not as qualified as Dr. Baker is. And this is not a challenge to Dr. Baker or any other medical examiner. We fully believe that 99.9% of the time, they're accurate. They get it right, and they do their job. But the 0.1% of the time that it's inaccurate or that it might not be correct, and when there's other medical examiners who are willing to testify that this is wrong, there should be a recourse for that family. There should be a way to correct that. And it's not just putting the decision in the judge's hands. If you have to have credible, admissible evidence, just as if I was going to bring a malpractice case against a doctor or a malpractice case against an attorney, I can't just go up there and say I think he's wrong. I have to have evidence to show that this other doctor thinks he's wrong as well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Schwartz. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I guess I've got a question that might be mostly targeted to the first testifier, the coroner, but maybe Representative Emmer. As I hear this discussion, a couple of different thoughts, and maybe you and the testifier can just react to this. One, it reminds me a little bit of the scenario we heard about in Illinois with Drew Peterson and his former wife, who was first ruled as an accidental death or something similar to that, was actually dug up from the grave for the family to have somebody re-examine. As I recall, the re-examination actually concluded homicide. As we've watched all the facts on TV, that scenario sure was suspicious to me, and I think to most reporters, which is what gravitated so many to cover this story. Does this have, I mean, this seems to me to be a little related to that idea of, in the extreme cases, there could be a little bit of chicanery, if you will. Certainly appears to be that way in Illinois, and the office in the county that Drew Peterson was a law enforcement officer with, seemingly having connections and influence and or sympathy from some. How does it relate to that? And secondly, the test of having to have somebody sign off to get into the court, I think you discussed this at the beginning, but it is very tough to find somebody in Minnesota to sign off on a medical malpractice case, as I think you know. And it sounds like that's the type of process you're mimicking here. So it's a fairly high standard to even get a scenario where there'd have to be a court review. Where am I wrong, or am I on the right track here?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Emmer.
Representative Westrom, there are two things there. I suppose the way I would like to respond to it is this. Whether it has to do with a case like the one that you're describing in Illinois, the reason that I'm pursuing this is because I believe we have there is a gap in our law. I thought that our justice system, I thought our society was supposed to provide remedies to people who have to have somewhere to turn. I have incredible respect for Dr. Baker. The few times that I met him, and you probably have gathered the same thing about his experience and education involvement in this area. It's got nothing to do with Dr. Baker. Everybody comes up and apologizes, gives their condolences to Ryan's family. I didn't realize till I went through the process a couple of times, it has nothing to do with Ryan's family.
in our system of government, and I know Dr. Baker and others don't like this because you've heard it a couple of times. Well, I just don't. In fact, I wrote down the last statement. I think it was Mr. Kingery said, remedy sets a bad precedent. And then there was a statement about that turning over, I don't think taking medical information and turning it over to judges is the right thing. That is the way our system is established. And in fact, it begs the question, in a murder trial where you have one medical examiner who has arrived at a cause of death, an expert opinion, and then you have another one who's hired by the defense to come in and offer a different opinion perhaps of causation, how it happened, why is it okay in that context, but it wouldn't be okay in this context? First, there's a gap in our law when it comes to remedies, and I have enormous respect for the Office of the Hennepin County Medical Examiner, but if you listen to the testimony, when they say it's going to add costs and it's going to take resources in this already strapped environment, well, listen to what they did in this case. They care about their job, so when they get the call, somebody says, I have questions about this death certificate, about your determination of causation. What does Dr. Baker, what does he do, what does his office do? What would we expect anyone in this position to do? They expend the resources immediately, internal. They review their own systems, they review their own opinions, they determine whether or not they're wrong. By his own testimony, he tells us that these are not set in stone. I changed one that's 20 years old because I got new information. This is already happening. It's a very small, very rare instance where somebody does not agree. And now what I would propose if this legislature established is a remedy that the bar is very high, Representative Westrom, when you say in the medical malpractice area, it does. It makes it very difficult. And when you put that clear and convincing standard on there, we're not asking a judge to be a medical expert. A judge is simply going to be the gatekeeper that says this expert is indeed qualified and has provided an opinion that is credible and needs to be considered. There was a statement earlier made that it doesn't provide the process, doesn't provide an explanation process. Well, if you understand the court system, and I understand a lot of people don't practice in it every day, you would know that in order to make a determination on causation, you can't just have one side. You're going to have to be able to examine the opinion against whatever the opinion was on the other side, which brings up the other issue of the cost. A lot of these people aren't going to be represented by county attorneys. First, within our court system, experts get reimbursed. There is a process where experts can get reimbursed if they are asked to testify in connection with the court proceeding. Second, this is what I tried to stay away from, and I hope the committee will. This is not supposed to be personal. It's being treated as though and you heard the testimony, that in this state, a lot of clinical physicians sign off on death certificates, not a forensic pathologist like Dr. Baker seated next to me. Clinical physicians sign off on them. Representative Westrom, there's a gap in our law, and I understand that the medical examiners are not comfortable necessarily getting reviewed by a district court. The standard that we've established is extremely high. The evidence from other states where you don't have necessarily trained forensic pathologists like Dr. Baker, in fact, I think it was Dr. Baker who said laypersons can even issue a cause of death. Those states that allow for this remedy, you've had 13 of these since 1958 in Ohio. I would ask this committee to look at the fact that we're talking about a remedy for people.
All right. Thank you for your comments, Representative. Are there any other questions at this time, or anyone in the audience who get a chance to speak that would like to speak either for or against? Seeing none, Representative Holberg renews her motion as amended, the House File 176 to finance. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. No.
Motion does not prevail. Division has been called. All those in favor, raise your hand, please. Thank you. And those opposed, raise your hand. The motion does not prevail on the tie vote.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson, if you would come to the table, please. Welcome, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll move House File 1322 to get the bill before us.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and the reason it's before the committee is there's a section in the bill related to data classification. It's on page 5, subdivision 5, and go over to page 6, so subdivision 5 and 6. I think that's why it's here. But just as an overview of the bill, what this bill is designed to do is actually to, we have an effort in the state and now with the federal stimulus money to expand the use of electronic medical records and interoperability of those records to share information and what this legislation is trying to do is to match. There's a lot of money at the federal level that states can access to help small providers and a variety of other providers get over the capital cost barriers of doing this. The bill is designed to align ourselves so we can pull down as much of that money as that grant money as possible. The data pieces in this bill, and Mr. Golden can come up and talk and answer more detail, but basically what the data pieces in this do is anybody that wants to participate, the federal law is going to require that those providers kind of give this information to the federal government. We want to align our state statutes so that happens. And then it classifies the data as non-public data. And what's really critical for the committee is there is no, this is business data. There's no patient identified data. There's no health record data involved in this discussion.
Representative Keith, I see you have an amendment. Would you like to do that at this time?
If I could, this is an amendment to kind of fix something that was raised in the last, and it's really an oral amendment. I have an amendment to the amendment to line it up with the actual lines of the bill. But I just want to have the language before committee members. So instead of 6.35, it should be 7.12. I don't know how you want to proceed, Mr. Chair.
I will incorporate that into the amendment.
Okay. All right, so people have it. But can I just make sure that it's, I have the actual line numbers. Maybe that would be easier for, if I can approach the bench.
All right. Very good. And we'll give that to.
So we'll just incorporate that. Okay.
Man.
It has nothing to do with the actual sections that we're talking about this committee. So I'll just end with that. If we want to answer questions, I'd be happy to do that.
Justin Holbert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say define business data,
Justin Peterson?
Yeah, and Mr. Golden can watch more detail about exactly what we're talking about here. That's probably the easiest way to
address it. Mr. Golden, briefly, if you'd identify yourself for the record and then go ahead and answer the question.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the Director of Health Policy at the Department of Health. Representative Holbrook, the type of business data that's there is data that would be related to various aspects of the types of electronic health records they're using, the types of thing that they're using them for. And one of the key issues under the federal stimulus package is there are $29 billion of incentives for Medicare and Medicaid healthcare providers for using an electronic health record. The amount of incentive that is available under Medicare is dependent on the volume of Medicare business that you do. Under Medicaid, it's the amount of Medicaid business that you do. One of the things that's going to be required in order to determine eligibility as well as the amount would be to look at your payer mix, meaning that you would have to be able to identify the amount of Medicare business that you're doing, the amount of private paid business that you're doing, the amount of public program business that you're doing, as well as any charity care that you're doing. That's data that's not broken out right now. Most of the healthcare providers tend to find that to be very sensitive data. So that would be the type of business data that is there. With regard to electronic health records, the type of data is really to evaluate that we're actually getting something for the $29 billion that we're spending in incentives. So it would look at issues such as, what are some of the functionalities that you're able to do? Can you do e-prescribing? Do you have the capacity to share problem lists and continuity of care records with other providers when your patient is changing spots? It's that type of data. It is not data on any individual patients or about patients at all.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Tishman, where in your bill does it say that they're prohibited from collecting any individually identifiable or health record type of data in this program?
Lines 6.18 and 6.19 says the commissioner shall not collect data or public analyses that identify or could potentially identify individual patients.
And Mr. Chair, if it's data about business practice, it's one thing. If it's data about healthcare practice, it's another. And so, while certainly they always say not individually identifiable, blah, 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 I'm concerned about just information even scrubbed of a name that's related to health issues on individuals.
And Mr. Chair, I'll answer by saying this: everything in the Minnesota, we're not changing the Health Records Act, we're not changing anything in our own privacy laws as related to that, but I'll let Mr. Golden address the specific. I mean, your question is, as they collect this aggregate data about case mix, for instance, is there going to be specific health information in there?
Mr. Chair, I have not a very good track history with the Department of Health doing what they say they are supposed to do. And given that long-standing problem, reoccurring problem, and pervasive problem across all kinds of programs with this department, I've gotten to the point where I don't trust them, and I'm looking for legislation that really very tightly prescribes what they can and can't do with information on individuals in order to try and nail down some of these practices that they continue to perpetuate when we don't prescribe very narrowly what their rights are. And so what I'm trying to figure out here is, what we're going to set up these programs and under a certain name, and then it's going to morph and change, and 5 years from now we're going to figure out we have a problem because we weren't clear enough in the enacting legislation, and I'm trying to avoid that.
Ms. Golden, you want to respond?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, I'll be as clear as possible on this. This data that's being collected as part of the requirements of the stimulus package does not require or need patient data in either identified or de-identified data. We don't need patients about we don't need data about patients in any form in order to do this. What we really need is patients about the healthcare provider or healthcare facilities. This is about the business of the.
And if I might, then
certainly, Representative Holberg.
Why didn't lines 6.18 and 6.19 reflect that then?
Representative,
Mr. Chair, I think that was the intent. But what we could say is language. Nothing in this section shall authorize the collection of patient data in identified or de-identified form. And would that's the intent. So does that...
In identified or de-identified form?
Yeah.
So in any form?
In any form, right. So nothing in this section authorizes the collection of patient data. Is that, or do you want to...
Yeah, that works really good for me, Mr. Chair. And
that. Okay, and Mr. Chair, patient, the one thing is the patient mix. So how many of your patients are on Medicaid, how many of your patients are on Medicare, how many of your patients are on private pay, how many are uninsured? That would be the one piece that could...
And you could Mr. Chair, it's deadline day and everybody's tired and probably not very many people care about this besides me, and I understand that.
Well, why don't we...
So, if you'd like to work on it before we get to the floor, I'm happy to do that so we don't waste the committee's time at this point.
And Mr. Chair, in fact, I'm willing to add that language in, knowing that we may have to tweak it a bit to kind of make sure we get that case next piece in. So, could someone move? Maybe Representative Holbert. Nothing in the second authorizes the collection of patient data.
Mr. Chair, I would move that.
Individual patient data? Would that?
Representative Holbert moves. Mr. Guerin can articulate the actual motion that's before us.
This is what I have. Nothing in this section authorizes the collection of individual patient data. And that would be on line 6.19.
Representative Holberg moves that. Do you have that, Mr. Smith? Very good. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And we also have the other amendment. Maybe Mr. Guerin can articulate that for us, and we'll vote on that. I'll move that as well.
Mr. Chair, the type of amendment that was passed out has been corrected so that it would read as follows. After line 7.12, insert new language, a contributing entity may not specify that the recipient or recipients of any loan use specific products or services, nor may the contributing entity imply that a contribution is an endorsement of any specific product or service, semicolon. Then line 7.32, strike and insert in parentheses 6 local public health departments as defined in chapter 145A, semicolon, and then at line 7.33, delete the 6 in parentheses and insert 7 in parentheses.
And Mr. Chair, basically what this is doing is it's creating a conflict of interest policy in a certain section and also adding public health as a eligible borrower.
Very good. I'll move that amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? A motion prevails. That amendment is included. Representative Holbert?
And Mr. Chair, just to establish some legislative intent here, for the witness from the Department of Health, if you're a person that when you go to your physician or any healthcare provider and you make note on the privacy standard that you are not authorizing any dissemination of any of your medical record unless it's required by law, would your information, as this bill is written, be included in this legislation?
Mr. Golden?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, Mr. Chair, the language that we put, we've changed it so we're not authorizing any individual data, but if you are a healthcare consumer concerned with privacy and on all your medical records you note that you are not giving any authority to disseminate any medical information unless it is required by law, would the medical information of an individual be included in this study if you made that type of directive?
Mr. Gold?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the medical record would not be included in this study, and it wouldn't be included in this study because this language provides neither any requirement nor authority for that type of data to be collected. So it wouldn't be included because there's no authority for us or requirement to collect that type of data.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holbert. Hearing no further discussion, I'm going to renew my motion to move House File 1322 to the General Register. Is that correct, Mr. Francisen? Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Thiessen.
Representative Simon, are you here for the point? Somebody want to move Representative Simons? Representative Hartman moves Representative Simons. Bill, is there any amendment for the author?
Pardon?
Any amendment for the
author? No amendment.
Okay. Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
happy deadline day. I know you have a lot more bills left, so I'll try to be quick on this bill. House File 1494 provides justice after wrongful death. Right now, if a legally recognized spouse is wrongfully killed, like in a car accident, the surviving spouse can sue the person responsible and recover expenses, medical expenses, funeral expenses, etc. Obviously, same-sex partners right now don't have that same right, and they have to pay the expenses on their own. This bill just updates and modernizes the law to provide same-sex couples with the right to recover costs after a wrongful death. And what I want to say, what I think I need to say, is that, you know, these are sensitive issues and topics. We all know that. I wasn't here for the previous discussion on Representative Murphy's bill, but I can pretty much predict how it probably went and what some of the comments were. And that's okay, because I think reasonable people can disagree on these issues. And I would never say that someone who voted against this bill cares any less than I do or the people who vote for the bill about our state and about making sure you know, we move our state forward. And I know that people's views on these questions are sometimes religious, sometimes they are cultural, sometimes they're political, or they're a blend of all three of those things. So I highly suspect that whatever discussion we have here today isn't going to change anyone's mind. I don't think anyone came into this committee hearing on this bill or other related bills and is going to vote a different way than they thought they would when they walked in this room. That's not to say we shouldn't have the discussion. It's to say that I understand that this is a sensitive topic and one on which people on both sides have very strong opinions, and their heartfelt opinions and the genuine opinions. I have mine, and I think this is the right thing to do for a number of reasons. I don't know, Mr. Chair, considering that you had a full discussion on a bill that was somewhat similar to this earlier, how much of that you want to repeat. I'm happy to answer questions, but I think people know what the bill does and they know how they're going to vote.
Okay. Representative Fortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would offer the same amendment I did in the last bill for the same reasons, that line 2.30, to strike that line and then correct the internal references. And the reason Representative Simon wasn't here when we discussed it, but your witness was, of not creating a new equal protection problem to replace the existing equal protection problem we have in the law. And so this would allow for the same situation if we have elderly persons who have taken up residence together but don't marry for a particular reason.
Representative Portman moves, and the council has given it to me. On page 2, delete line 30 and correct the internal references. I don't see any discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Does anybody want to discuss this bill anymore? I think everybody understands it. Representative Drzkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question, and thank you, Representative Simon. Is this limited to two people, or could it be more than two people involved here?
Chair. I'm sorry, Mr. Simon. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it would only be two people.
Representative Truskowski. Okay, I think everybody's ready to vote and understands the bill. Representative Hortman renews her motion to pass House File 1494 and send it to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried.
Thank you, members.
Representative Davin. Okay.
Is this a laptop? Mr. Chair, do laptops communicating with the internet interfere with the...
The laptop? I don't think the laptop do. I think somebody's cell phone. Does somebody have a...
I have a cell phone.
Turned on?
Yes, and I just turned it off, Mr. Okay. Chair. I just came from someplace else, that's why. So I did turn it off.
Is there any witnesses here on Representative Dabney's bill? No witnesses on Representative Dabney's bill? Are there any opponents? I'm having to oppose something that hasn't been presented.
Maybe we can take your statement while he's coming. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard here on behalf of Katie America. Just two comments to represent Dabney's bill. This is a work in progress. We've been negotiating language for back and forth the last couple of days. A couple of things that I want to point out. We were trying to reach agreement on are in the bill. And if you have the amendment or the bill in front of you with regard to the scope of the bill on page 3, line 1.
Representative, we gave you a chair. We can't put you in it and tie you in it.
You just didn't shackle me to it. We just would have solved it.
So you're on a roll. Clearly.
All right. Thank you, Chair. I'll finish my comments. The one point that we are trying to reach agreement on is basically the scope of the bill under the definitional section of consumer short-term loan. There seems to be a disagreement over how this should be defined. This bill, as originally introduced, was to regulate unsecured or uncollateralized payday loans. The definition here, at least the way it's written right now, we're afraid it might actually capture collateralized loans up to $1,000. So we're just trying to figure out that language. We've been working with Mr. Elwood and Representative Dabney, and we'll continue to do so.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Dabney, I will move your bill, House File 914, and I believe it goes to the General Register.
Oh, that's correct. I thought Mr. Cassidy Pratt had already moved it.
Then I will move the, I believe you want the A2 amendment?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All in favor of the A2 amendment to get it in shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you.
Our representative, now you can explain the bill very quickly.
All right. Ms. Chair, as I trust has already been explained to the committee, we have this bill attempts to put some additional consumer protections and definitions around the payday lending industry in Minnesota. It is a significantly slimmed down and significantly less controversial issue or bill than it was upon introduction and moving through the process. Initially, we have removed some language that the industry found objectionable. Mr. Cassidy was correct. At this point, we're trying to get around a definition of short-term consumer loan and the collateralized versus non-collateralized issue is where I think both sides are trying to bring the right expertise to the table to understand that I am not the right expertise. I won't speak for Mr. Cassidy, but I do know people who are, and we're trying to get everyone together to figure out that last piece.
Okay. Mr. Cassidy, did you want any more, or are you satisfied? Anybody else want to speak on this? Okay. I renew my motion to pass House File 914 as amended to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.